Right, hi. Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this presentation on the subject of the three pillars of insurance. I'm going to introduce our speaker, Jason Gordon. Jason's a member of the Australian Institute of Actuaries, fellow with more than 10 years of experience in life insurance. He's done group life, direct and retail life insurance in that time, both looking at pricing and valuation. I'm going to read this bit out, Jason. Sorry. Jason was previously a member of the Institute's Risk Management Practice Committee and currently a member of the Wealth Management Subcommittee, reporting through to the Life Insurance and Wealth Management Practice Committee. Jason was the 2010 Life Insurance Finalist for the Financial Services Council Deloitte Future Leaders Award. I've just got a couple of bits of housekeeping before I hand it over to Jason. First of all, I've got to tell you not to play with your phones, and second of all, I've got to tell you to keep texting and tweeting about the conference, which seem to be two completely conflicting bits of information and advice, but that's what I've been told to say. So with that in mind, I'm going to hand it over to Jason. Thank you.
Thanks, Richard. So good afternoon. Today we're going to be looking at the three pillars of insurance coverage. We're going to start with a brief overview, then move on to the history of health insurance in Australia, as well as the history of terrorism insurance on commercial property, then come back to the three pillars to see if there are any overarching principles or characteristics that we can see that govern the allocation of insurance coverage between the three pillars. Most of the presentation will be spent on the history of health insurance, and that's partly because of its unique position that it occupies, being universal access that is fully funded by government revenue. So if we can understand this quite well, then it may shed some light on the other pillars. So this three-pillar framework was borrowed from the superannuation industry. On the left-hand side, we have universal cover. That is akin to the state government pension that everyone is or may be entitled to if they meet the means tests. On the right-hand side, we have voluntary cover. That is akin to the additional voluntary superannuation contributions that you may make through salary sacrificing. And in the middle, we have cover which is governed by either legislative mandate or professional compulsion. And that is similar to the 9.5% compulsory guarantee that your employer must make on your behalf. If we look at universal cover, we probably should also focus on hospital cover, because that is more akin to what is covered by an insurance benefit, that being a low-frequency but high-impact event. Medical benefits, most people can actually budget and afford a trip to the GP. Looking at pillar two, you could actually split that. So you've got professional compulsion on the one-hand side, and on the left-hand side, you've got the government mandate. And you can really split that again into that which is supplemented by supply, so where the government enters as a manufacturer, versus supplemented by demand, where the government passes legislation to assist in the industry for either demand or regulatory purposes. So this raises some interesting questions. What are the principles or characteristics which govern the allocation of insurance benefits? Is there a difference, for example, between corporate cover versus personal cover? And what's the role of some vested interests? So the reason why I started thinking about insurance in the context of three pillars is really mainly the harsh treatment that life insurance advisors have received over the past 18 months. If we put our distribution hats on, we can see from pillar one, the government is mainly concerned about universal access, so making sure every Australian citizen has access to the same hospital and medical benefits. If we then move to pillar two and pillar three, where there is more of a role for private enterprise in the distribution, you can see that in pillar two, you're actually looking at an environment where demand is supplemented. Everything else being equal, that should make distribution a bit easier. On the right-hand side, where it's completely voluntary, that is more of an environment of demand apathy. So if you think of a risk-return trade-off, if you're choosing to partake in the voluntary distribution or distribution of voluntary insurance coverage, you should be entitled to a high return, everything else being equal. It also raises some other interesting aspects. So in an environment of demand apathy, does automatic cover through superannuation of life insurance help with financial literacy? So before we go on and look at the history of health insurance, we'll have a look at the definition of a public good. Now, public goods are goods which are best provided for by governments or charitable institutions. And that the main reason for that is because private enterprise can't strike a price. They have two characteristics. One is non-rivalry of consumption, and the other is non-excludability. So if we have a look at the classic example of national defence, once the Australian government sets up a national defence force, my consumption of that service doesn't inhibit anyone else's consumption of that service. And if we look at non-excludability, the Australian government can't actually exclude anyone from enjoying the benefits of that service. So private markets can't price for it. If we now think of either general life or health insurance, they don't naturally fit the definition of insurance as a public good. So if we have the government step in and start to provide manufacturing of insurance benefits, it may indicate that there has been a failure in private markets to provide that cover. And in particular, we're looking at the Pillar 1, so universal cover, and that component of Pillar 2 where the government supplements supply. So what you see above on the slide are the principles that were espoused in the second reading of the Medibank legislation in 1973. The reason why these are important is because this is the first time in Australian history that you had universal access that was fully supplemented by Commonwealth government revenue. So this begs to the question of how important are these principles? What role did they play in driving Medibank? And we can see that actually these principles really were in existence well before World War II, so 30 years prior to the Medibank legislation. You had universal hospital cover in Queensland from 1944, in Tasmania from the period 1937 to 1952, and you also had universal, with a small U, medical benefits through the National Health and Pension Insurance Bill in 1938. That was going to be a general practitioner service. It was passed by both houses of parliament but never fully implemented because the country party of the coalition thought it was going to give too much power to the unions. The impending war also meant that there were economic reasons for not implementing that bill. So what you see is a timeline from Federation in 1901 right up to 1972. The reason why this period is important is because from 1972, you have the Whitlam government come to power and they start organising the passing of the Medibank legislation through the House of Representatives. So by far and away, one of the most interesting aspects of the health insurance history in the last 20th century was the period from about 1952 through to 1972. In this period, you had the medical organisation or organised medicine control not just the supply, but heavily influenced the administration and also control the price for medical benefits. Essentially, the Commonwealth government was in a position where they underwrote medical incomes. So how this came about, partly it was because of the inability of the Labor government from 1941 to 1949 to pass any meaningful legislation in the face of opposition from organised medicine. You then had, once Menzies came to power in 1949, a total appeasement of organised medicine. To get a really good understanding of the institutional changes which happened because of this, we probably need to go back and look at the main players in the healthcare industry from around 1901. From the late 19th century right up to 1951, most people in Australia received medical care benefits through the friendly societies. I should point out at this time, the public hospital system, it was, as we know it, didn't really exist. There were public hospitals, but they were run by charities and religious institutions, and they were predominantly for the poor. They were unsafe places. You didn't want to visit them. If you could afford it, you actually wanted to be treated by your local GP at your home. But if we get back to the friendly societies, they were the dominant intermediary. You paid a contribution to your friendly society, and on your behalf, they would negotiate a list of fees with your general practitioner. And those list of fees would be paid to the general practitioner on a per capitation basis. So anything outside that list of fees was a fee for service. So naturally, there was a lot of tension between the medical profession on the one hand, always pushing to limit that schedule of fees, and the friendly societies on the other, trying to expand it. If you actually look at the structure of the medical organisation, vast majority of medical practitioners were general practitioners with their own practice. So these guys were small business people. The education costs for medicine were very high. They often left university with large amounts of debt. They were heavily reliant on the friendly societies for a healthy flow of people to come through, and specialisation itself was extremely expensive. One doctor at the time commented that few doctors could emancipate themselves from general practice. So this is when specialisation was also becoming of age. It really happened in World War I on the hospitals on the Western Front. You have radiology and orthopaedics start to become very popular, and also through technology. So in the 1920s, with the advent of the motor car, there were a lot of people that lined the inpatient wards of public hospitals because of broken bones due to motor vehicle accidents. So orthopaedics also got a boon there. As a result of specialisation, you can think of the additional equipment that was needed. This is way beyond the capacity for either a general practitioner or private hospitals to afford. So state governments started getting involved in the funding of public hospitals. So if you put yourself in the shoes of your local GP, I should also actually point out that the Great Depression played a large role. A lot of people who were unemployed could no longer afford to make contributions to their friendly society, so that forced them onto the public hospital system. So that's obviously to the demise of your GP, and forced even more state government intervention. If you put yourself in the shoes of your local GP, and unfortunately it's a bit different to aerial ski jumping, I can't get yourselves to all stand up, put your hands on your knees and pretend to do a somersault, but your local GP was someone who had a high amount of debt, was forced to take capitation fees from your local friendly society, and was starting to see the fringes, but the very profitable components of their practice move towards the public hospital system. So this included things like obstetrics. Obstetrics was fee-for-service, and that was... as you see that move to the public hospital system, your GP's no longer got that type of income from that servicing, but also generally obstetrics was the introduction of a new patient on which you could earn additional fees. So you can see increased marginalisation of your GP, and the medical profession actually starts to resent any form of government involvement in medicine, either from the point of view of them taking an increasing role in public hospital system, and also through legislation. So socialised medicine became a very popular term from the medical profession. They actually viewed any form of intervention by the government as a Trojan horse for a salaried medical service. This is the real reason why the Pharmaceuticals Benefit Act in 1944 was defeated. It was actually essentially a scheme that was going to provide Australians with subsidised and free pharmaceuticals. It was going to be administered from the Commonwealth Department. So that was the reason why the medical services, organised medicine, was strongly against the Pharmaceuticals Benefits Act. If we now look at the voluntary health insurance scheme in 1952, this provided universal access, but it wasn't free. So there were two components here. In the hospital system, it created two classes of people. Firstly, the heavily subsidised means-tested people. They received free treatment. Anyone else that didn't receive the means tests, that didn't meet the means tests, you had to pay fee for service. But you received a subsidy from the Commonwealth Government just so long as you were a member of a private health insurer. So this was actually a boon for the private health insurance industry as well. On the medical benefits side, pensioners received free service, and the working class would still receive service on a capitation basis through the friendly societies. That was, again, means tested. If you didn't meet those means tests, you had to pay fee for service. You could receive a subsidy, but the subsidy was at a lower rate. And again, you had to be a member of a private health insurer. So Earl Page, who was the Minister for Health at the time, he was a doctor himself. He thought this was going to be a great scheme. He would get the medical profession on side. It actually expanded fee-for-service, and it also meant that medical incomes were also more secure. But the core problem actually was administration. The medical profession actually viewed this as being given too much power to the friendly societies. because they saw that their ranks would actually swell. So they did two things about this. The first one was they set up their own medical benefits fund, MBF. That was in 1944. That became a private company in 1946 and expanded from New South Wales to Queensland and Victoria. And that only offered medical benefits and hospitalisation on a fee-for-service basis. From the period of mid-1950 up to September 1951, they then cut all their contracts. Every state-based medical profession cut their contracts with the friendly societies. They would no longer provide services on a per capitation basis. It would now be fully fee-for-service. So if you think about the institutional changes which that, I guess, doing that made, it essentially you eliminated any form of control on the cost of medical services in the healthcare industry. And the federal government just sat beside them and didn't do anything actually about this. So you can see that from a structural perspective, the organised medicine controls the supply. They have heavily influence on the demand, on the administration, sorry, and they control the pricing. So much so that by the mid-1960s, you have the BMA-controlled MBF and Blue Cross funds, which were heavily aligned, control about 70% of the market, and the Friends Societies controlled only 30%. So any system where you have control of both supply and pricing is open to abuse, and the medical profession did this primarily through protecting their members from accountability and financial control. There was no contract between your local GP and the Commonwealth government, and that meant that the friendly societies, the organised medicine could increase their fees, and they would automatically place the government under pressure to increase their contributions. So this is the outcome of the Nimmo Committee in 1969, which was the Liberal Party's response to growing discontent with the voluntary medical service. And there are a few things which need to be pointed out. Firstly, the voluntary insurance scheme was decentralised administration, and you can see from one of the points that they criticised that the large number of contributions were absorbed in operating expenses. There were also a few other components of this which made it quite critical. Firstly, you actually had hospitals using debt collectors to extract fees, and about 20% of the population had no coverage. So 70% of the population had coverage through private health insurers, 10% were pensioners, and the 20%, which were most likely going to be the people who really couldn't afford not to be sick, so your lower socioeconomic status people, they had no coverage. So if we hark back to the definition of a public good and why the reason that look at the reasons why government may get involved in the provision of insurance benefits, partly because of market failure, this is a clear example of market failure from the voluntary insurance side of provision of healthcare benefits. So this is another timeline. This timeline is from 1968, which is when Whitlam announced his new healthcare scheme, which was Medibank, right up to the dismissal of his government in 1975. So with the failings of a decentralised system, you're actually really waiting for a challenge to radicalise the current status quo, and that's exactly what Whitlam did in his Medibank proposal. There were a few things which changed. Firstly, everyone would receive universal medical benefits, but that was subsidised at 85% contribution from the government. The crucial change was bulk billing. So you have a contract between your GP and the government, and you then had universal hospital benefits for both inpatient and outpatient clinics for public patients. Doctors who service public patients in public hospitals could only would only be paid on a sessional or salaried basis. So it ticked all the boxes that the medical profession was fighting against. Medicare also changed the institutional power of the healthcare system. Post 1 July 1975, which was when Medibank became operational, the government had a proven ability to process healthcare claims on a huge scale. So we're talking about 100,000 claims a day. Now, this was really important not just for Whitlam, but also for Fraser, who took over who won government after December 1975. He didn't eliminate Medibank, much to the anger of the private health insurers, and instead he kept it but made a few changes. To get the private health insurers on board, because they were thinking the Liberal government would actually retract Medibank completely, he actually enabled Medibank, given its proven performance in processing healthcare benefits, to compete with the private health insurance industry. So you can see that once the government has a proven ability, they can use that to force the private market to have some sort of cost control. That was also very important. Medibank Private was also very important for the Hawke government, because by 1981, Fraser had whittled away Medibank back to a voluntary insurance scheme, and all the Hawke government had to do to implement Medicare was essentially take what Medibank Private was doing and scale it up. So from an operational perspective, it was quite easy for Hawke. But if you actually go back to the Joint Sitting of Parliament in August 1974, where Medibank was approved and passed through legislation to 1 July 1975, in less than a year, the Whitlam government actually got Medibank being operational, which was quite amazing given of the operational challenges they faced. They first had to find retail outlets for Medibank. They had to hire over 2,000 staff, train them. They had to set up a centralised computer system, which was state-of-the-art at the time, set up peripheral computer services to feed information back to that, back to the central government, back to Canberra. So from an operational perspective, even though the Whitlam government had huge problems from a legislation and popularity perspective, Bill Hayden and his team did something which was quite remarkable for the time. So we've covered health insurance in quite a bit of quite fast, but that doesn't mean that there was a lot of opposition through the passing of the Medibank legislation. You had the Liberal Party block the supply legislation for funding. You had the AMA against it. State governments, particularly the Labor ones, were dragging their heels, and also private insurers, and at one stage the Catholic private hospitals were also against it. So if we move on to terrorism insurance coverage, these are a few extracts from the explanatory memorandum of the Treasury Insurance of the Terrorism Insurance Bill in 2002. So after September 2001, you have a virtual disappearance of terrorism coverage on commercial property across not just Australia but the world. So there was this had a few economic implications, particularly in the delaying of investment. The government saw clear market failure, and they decided to make, I guess, the scheme compulsory to ensure its long-term sustainability. But they had a sunset clause. So these were the principles that were espoused in the legislation. But if you think of what the government did within the space of less than 2 years, because by 1 July 2003, the Australian Reinsurance Pool Corporation was fully operational, compare that to healthcare, it was quite remarkable. So if we now go back to the three pillars, there are just a few observations. Firstly, in universal cover and the pillar two, where the government supplements supply, terrorism reinsurance kind of looks out of place. I know workers' compensation is a corporate cover, but it is there to protect workers. And if you also think of what was in the supplement of supply previously, which was before the sale of Medibank Private, you had private health insurance in there as well. So there are a few long-term trends which influence the movements between the three pillars. And the first one is, I guess, the welfare state, which was where you saw government provision of unemployment benefits, healthcare and pensions. The second one is deregulation or free market liberalism, which meant that you saw life insurance move, or governments exit the manufacturing of life insurance in the late 1990s. And then you also see economies of scale. So economies of scale from a planning and education perspective. You would not have been able to have a universal healthcare system in the early 19th century just because you didn't have enough doctors, nor did you have enough public hospital infrastructure. The population pyramid also plays, that's going to have probably more greater implications later on this century in terms of the affordability of universal care. And then you also have technological capability from an administrative perspective. So again, harking back to Medibank, their ability to process claims. That was state-of-the-art technology. You would not have been able to do that from a central government perspective 10 years earlier. If we have a quick look at tax, this is a chart of the composition of Australian tax revenue for most of the 20th century, and you can see there was an uptick in 1942 to 43 to pay for the war, and then another uptick from 1972 to 73. You can interpret that from 1972 to 73 as sort of paying for the welfare state, but it hovers around 10%. If you then look at a similar chart for the US, you can see that their income tax rocked up after 1940, so that's the blue component there, and stayed well above 10%, but they never actually implemented a universal healthcare scheme, and they still don't have one. So these are a few of the parameters that may explain the allocation in the existing environment, so excluding long-term trends. If we take a look at professional compulsion, we can see, most medical students are told at some stage in their career through hospital when they're going through their education that they will be sued. So the rule of law and having a litigious society means that medical professional indemnity is certainly something which you're going to look to get as you go into private practice. As we saw in universal cover, you saw market failure of the voluntary insurance scheme. You also saw that in the terrorism insurance cover. And I guess if you look at the voluntary cover, you can also say there was probably almost irrelevance from a workers' compensation and also lack of externalities. So if we think of workers' compensation, it is cover which is purchased by a corporate entity, but that is primarily the result because employers owe their workers an obligation to have a safe working environment. So there are externalities there which and vested interests which almost force the government's hand. But it does mean that it can infringe on the relevance of life insurance, because if people have workers' compensation, they may believe that they don't need any life insurance cover. The interesting one there is also in this where the government supplements demand, and that is the last point there on maintaining long-term industry sustainability. That is, more from a private health insurance perspective. So that's the end of the presentation. If there's any, comments on either the three pillars or why people may have different opinions as to why some insurance benefits are in one pillar and not in the other.
Thanks. If anyone has questions, can I ask you to come up to the microphone in the middle of the room there? And if you can let us know your name and who you work for.
Hi, I'm Lisa Simpson from PwC. I'm really interested in actually the interaction of the pillars when you look at the welfare system and the income supports provided through welfare, particularly the disability support pension and other welfare pensions, compared to workers' compensation. Because what I observe in my industry is the workers' compensation schemes contracting, reducing benefits, and as a result, there's increasing utilisation of the disability support pension.
Mm-hmm.
Another area I'm also interested in is the government's involvement in the National Disability Insurance Scheme, trying to provide universal coverage to help people with supports when they're disabled, and that changing the market, I guess, it was previously there, which might have been a government-mandated market, maybe into more of a universal market. I wonder if you had any comments on those two different areas.
So the first question was workers' comp, and sorry, what was the other?
The National Disability Insurance Scheme.
Okay. For the NDIS, I put that probably if you have a look at the... See, if you see universal health insurance and you look at the medical benefits, the NDIS is not really insurance coverage. It's after an event managing your way through being disabled. So it's not really insurance in that regard, which is why I said at the start we probably should focus on hospital cover. I don't know enough about the NDIS, but if you compare it to universal medical benefits, there would be certainly an interaction, like you said, not just with workers' compensation and the healthcare system, but also the healthcare system and NDIS. I'm not an expert on the NDIS. I probably If anyone in the audience has any opinions on that, I'm more than willing to take them. That's something I probably need to look into. Anyone disagree with?
I was going to say, I think the presenter has just asked a question. Anyone care to respond?
Well, from a distribution perspective, do you think that everyone think that the distribution of voluntary cover is harder, and therefore that distributors should earn a or be entitled to a higher return? Does there need to be any transfer of knowledge, for example, for travel insurance?
I think mine, for what it's worth, is that I agree with you. I think there probably should be compensation for taking on the stuff that the government isn't going to take on. I think it's very clear. To my mind, it's clear that there should be compensation for that.
Yeah, I think for voluntary cover, you're sort of left out on your own. It's a lot easier to attack life insurance or focus on life insurance if almost there are limited vested interests apart from life insurance companies themselves and their distribution entities. If you go back to the 1990s, if you were to attack financial advisors who were distributing life insurance, you actually had some state governments who were manufacturing life insurance. So there may have been at least a check on how far regulators could go.
I'm from the UK and obviously grown up and worked there, and I've been part of all sorts of reviews for things that have been missold and that sort of thing, and I'm never aware of a government having been blamed and giving anyone any compensation for anything they've missold. So there's no doubt the private sector takes on far more risk in this regard, and sometimes they pay a very, very heavy price for it.
Builder's warranty insurance. Stuart Oldfield's my name. I run a business called Field Research and also write for Fairfax. Builder's warranty insurance is a very niche product, but it's moving, as I understand it, from voluntary to market failure. So at a state government level, it's moving into legislatively mandated product. Please correct me if I'm wrong, and I'd be also interested in your thoughts of private health insurance at the moment is undergoing a major review under Graham Samuel, who I think is speaking at an actuarial function here in a couple of weeks. What's the prospect of universal changes being made there?
Answer the last part first. On the private health insurance industry, there is already supporting legislation, so lifetime cover guarantee, which essentially means that everyone pays the same amount of money. So I can't remember the phrase for that. There is a lot of support there. That was passed mainly to ensure the financial stability of the private health insurance sector, because you had a lot of people who were just entering when they needed it, which was later on in life, and that's when it was most expensive. I'm not sure. If you think of what private health insurance, it's really offering the fringes of the health insurance now, because their role reduced dramatically after Medicare. So I don't know. I don't know the likelihood of them moving from all the other. I guess you've also seen the government exit the private health insurance industry, so with the sale of Medibank Private. So I can't see any huge changes there, but again, I'm not a health insurance actuary. I'm probably not too familiar with that. On the builder's warranty insurance, I mean, I haven't included everything in this list just because there's too many types of coverage, particularly on the general insurance side. If there has been market failure, then I guess from past experience you can almost certainly see that, if you have market failure and you have a lot of vested interests, say in this case homeowners, and you want to support a healthy construction industry, So you'd have union involvement as well. Just from what we've seen in the past is that, if vested interests get involved and they have a lot of power, then you can see that type of insurance move towards a position where the government supplements supply or supplements demand. But again, I'm not an expert on builder's warranty insurance.
Hi, I'm Eilish Hurley from MLC. So when I look at this, and kind of triggered by the builder's warranty question, in the early 2000s we had, you know, what was viewed as a failure of the liability market here, and it was actually that just as I came over from the UK, and it was really interesting to be on the plane, and front page news like Sydney Morning Herald or the Fin Review was all about insurance. And kind of, you know, this wasn't what I was used to. Insurance was always in the back pages. But so kind of working through that, you know, people couldn't get their insurance coverage for the local school fates or whatever it was, and this whole outcry about affordability and availability of liability cover, with insurers, for good reasons, opting out of the market because, you know, they just couldn't make money given their rising costs. And what happened was the government came in, you know, the various Royal Commissions and the different states came in with their legislation about what could and couldn't be claimed for, and so caps on damages and all of that. And so as we're sitting here in the middle at the minute with kind of some similarities with income protection and TPD, trauma, group cover, do you see anything there about kind of this movement from government mandate, whether it wasn't exactly supplementing the supply or demand, but it was bringing in legislation, or the states were bringing in legislation to kind of control the cover and the claims, and that allowed the insurers to come back in and actually create a viable market again. Do you see anything, any kind of thing that will play out here when we're looking at the kind of disability issues that we're seeing at the minute?
I think you may have seen, in the last 5 years, some changes to the disability definitions, particularly for TPD. I think Australian Super has a more restrictive definition now. The workers' compensation, I think they're undergoing a review at the moment as well, along similar lines. Part of it is because they're looking at because common law and going through the courts was too costly, so you have either the choice of a no liability scheme or you have the choice of going through the courts. And they're, I guess, looking at that that component as well, which is better. So is it better for people to, once they get injured, to go through the court system, which could delay your payment by quite a number of years, or is it better to have a no-fault scheme where you have a schedule of payments that if you meet the definition of the injury, you get that payment immediately.
Do you think any of that would come in now on the life insurance side as opposed to the general side?
I don't.
Trying to control income protection, TPD, trauma, kind of the flow out of claims there?
Well, that's probably more of a... that's probably more on the general insurance side. I mean, you have had a blowout on the retail side for income protection as well. The group life cover. I think for group life, it's going to be really the response of the industry funds. So I said before, you've seen Australian Super restrict their definition. You may have a restriction of definitions in income protection, but I think that might be harder. On the retail side for income protection, I think if you think of the way you can either regulate via price or product. And lately it's just been price, with insurers not changing their product but increasing the premiums for that. I can't see a change in the definitions or the benefits available under income protection. But that's, again, my personal view.
Thanks, Jason. Are there any more questions? Or I'm sensing that perhaps everyone's ready for their lunch. And... anything else? In that case, I'm inclined to let everyone go. If we can just thank Jason, please, in the traditional manner.